Roundtable.
Hello and welcome to Radio Maraya Roundtable. I'm Yaj Garang. We are sorry for a little bit delay that happened. This is because of some technical issues in the studio. We begin now. We are looking at the topic of our discussion today is small arms control, communal conflict, and the status of disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration in South Sudan. Parties to the RRCs have largely observed agreement on cessation of hostilities signed on 21st December 2017 and permanent ceasefire signed in the Khartoum Declaration of 27th June 2018, which came into effect on 1st July 2018. Despite this escalation of political violence among the signatories of the revitalized agreement, the endemic communal conflict across the states in South Sudan continued to wage heavy toll on lives of civilians in the country. Prevalence of small arms in the hands of civilians and deadly culture of cattle rustling and revenge killing continue to exacerbate the violent conflict situation at the subnational levels. The RRC's demand reconstitution of DDR Commission and subsequent disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of ex-combatants in the society. Such move of security sector reform is aimed at stabilizing security and improving livelihood of ex-combatants with peace dividends. In the studio, we are joined by Wilson Lualual, a national expert of DDR Commission and acting executive director of DDR Commission. Welcome, Dr. Lual.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We are also joined by Abram Kuch, Director of Small Arms Control in the Bureau of Community Security and Small Arms Control in the Ministry of Interior. Welcome, Mr. Kuch.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
In the studio with us too is Dr. Abram Kualmion, Dean of College of Economic and Social Studies, University of Juba, and security expert. Welcome, Dr. Abram.
Thank you.
We shall be joined later by one of the guests. She's Maria Oniwa, a reintegration international expert with DDR Commission. She's joining us shortly. Gentlemen, you are welcome to the studio, Radio Maraya Roundtable. We are sorry for the delay that had happened. Let's begin.
Thank you.
Lual, what is the status of DDR program in South Sudan?
Okay, thank you very much for hosting us this morning, Maraya Talk Show. As all of you are aware, the DDR Commission has been reconstituted way back September 11, 2019. A number of activities have been carried out. All these activities, as all of you know, have been curtailed by COVID-19 advent, but still more has been done. To begin with, when the DDR Commission was reconstituted, based on the agreement, it drew a number of members from the political parties that have signed the agreement. Among them is the IT Gono, from which I come from, which is the government, and most of other members comes from IWO, from FDs, from OPP, from SOA, and this have turned up for the job, all of them. When they came to the DDR Commission as a new board or as a new commission, the first thing that I have to be done was to draft the basic documents that will guide the operationalization of the DDR mandate.
What are these documents?
One of the key basic documents that was developed is the policy document. Because the DDR Commission, as stipulated by the agreement, is to be guided by the DDR policy. Okay. Subsequently, there has to be also the strategy and the program that will guide the operationalization of the DDR policy.
Yeah.
The other document is the reintegration strategy. And then the following document is the reinsertion strategy, followed by public information strategy, and the last document is the standard operating procedures that will guide the internal conduct for the DDR Commission headquarters. As all of you are aware, because DDR Commission has to become the independent commission, there has to be an act that is to be enacted for the commission. So the bill is also drafted and is now in front of the Artigono, awaiting the reconstituted parliament to be passed. So these are the documents that the DDR Commission has to first put in place to be able to guide the new commission.
So in a nutshell, you are telling our listeners that all these documents that you have mentioned, including the bill, are all ready.
They have been completed. Uh-huh. They are now ready. And the other documents have been already passed by the NTC, which is the current body now that is supervising the DDR Commission. The only thing that is waiting for the approval of the parliament is the bill. But the rest of the documents are operational now.
Thank you. We shall come back to you. Abram.
Yes.
What is the status of the Smolam Bureau of Control in the country?
Thank you so much, Yajgarang, for having me, and thank you to some of my colleagues who are here from the DDR and Dr. Abram from the University of Java. I think it's the second time that we're actually meeting here again. Mm. And to answer your question directly, what the status of the small arms in the country is, I would say South Sudan really is flooded with small arms and light weapons. And the fact that a lot of the civil populations are carrying firearms because of so many reasons, some of which are enumerated in our policy document. And so if you want to know what we do as a country, so we have a national policy on the control of the civilian populations in South Sudan. We also have something called the Firearms Act, which actually regulates on how guns are supposed to be, used or carried in this country. And we have also developed the regulations in line with that. And lastly, as I'm telling you now, we have rolled out an awareness and sensitization campaign on the upcoming voluntary civilian disarmament.
When is it coming?
Well, that's the question that I cannot be able to tell
answer
you.
Now.
Yeah, definitively okay. Right now. Mm-hmm. But I hope there is going to be a national civilian disarmament that is going to come soon. And there is precondition that is attached to that. One, when there is a total peace and stability in the country, you cannot possibly do a complete and comprehensive civilian disarmament when there are other members of our society or our country that are still holding out and they still have guns. They have not joined the peace.
Abram, this is a very sensitive issue that you have brought into this discussion. Mm. And for sure our listeners would like to know, and this is the question that they would have asked. Mm. Now, some disarmament has been going on in Lagos State, in Greater Upper Nile, some areas, then in Warap State. Mm. And of late, we have had a clash between civilian and disarming forces in Toyin. Mm. And the argument that these communities who are targeted for disarmament advance is that some of the neighboring communities in Unity States are not being disarmed, and here we are being disarmed. And the case of recent case is justified that argument. Mm. So this thing, is it being done in collaboration with Small Arm Control Bureau of Small Arm Control, or the army doing it unilaterally?
Well, I think the army is not doing it unilaterally. First of all, let me answer the idea that some communities are being disarmed, others are not being disarmed. Mm. You know, it's not the policy of the government to carry out a comprehensive civilian disarmament. What the government is doing at the moment is the government is trying to intervene into the pockets of places where the communities are engaged in conflict and armed violence. Mm. So like what was happening in Toyin, Toyin has been embroiled in such a long intercommunal conflict for a very long period of time. So when the government sees this, it was the request of the communities of Toyin themselves so that disarmament is done in their communities. So when the government went there, the government did not just go there to forcefully disarm the communities of Toyin in isolation. Mm. So the government was responding to the conflict that has been there. And having said that, It's the policy of the government is that there is going to be a comprehensive disarmament across the nation. And there are civilian disarmament that has been conducted. You mentioned about the Lake State. Mm. Lake State has seen a lot of civilian disarmament from 2000 up to now. Jonglei has seen a lot of disarmament from 2005 until 2015. 2012, when the lone red community clashed with the SSPDF. Mm. So we can say that pretty much the disarmament that we have been doing is for us as a government to respond to where there is conflict and armed violence within and outside the communities that they are. What you are saying is something that we have been hearing in the awareness campaign. Mm. They are saying, okay, we will be disarmed. So what about the other communities? Are they going to be disarmed as well?
Yeah.
I was in Jonglei. The Jonglei people are telling me, the people of Bor are saying, if we are going to be disarmed, we are willing to relinquish our firearms. Are our neighbors from the people ready to do that? Are our neighbors from the Lawnwood ready to do that? You know, you find these questions are everywhere, every community that you are going. And that's why, as a government, we came up with a roadmap that says we are supposed to do a national disarmament. And we have to start bluntly. You know, it's not going to be forceful as at the moment. We need to start it bluntly so that whoever that is willing to bring out their guns peacefully now can hand it over. But there will be a period when the government will say enough is enough. We are going to remove it from you forcefully if you don't give us your gun.
Yeah, you have mentioned Lagos State before I go to Dr. Abram.
Yes.
You have mentioned Lagos State and Jonglei State. Mm. These areas have seen a number of disarmament, whether forceful or bluntly disarmament. Mm. But still, these areas still have the highest record of death as a result of small arms. So why is this thing happening? Where are guns coming from? You are taking guns and still people are dying in big numbers. Where are guns coming from? What do you know about this?
Well, you know, the first thing for us to answer when we are trying to look at the sources of the firearms is where does the guns actually come from? Mm. You know, when I was in Rumbek, they say we cannot be able to go and buy guns in Ethiopia.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, they cannot go to Sudan. They cannot even go to even Juba here to come and buy guns. Mm. So the guns that are in the circulation, most of our guns come from our national stockpile, you know. In other words, they come from our own stockpile, the stores that are owned by the government. And I'm not accusing anybody, all the organized forces. Mm. I'm just saying there are some rogue elements there, whether in the SSPDF, in the National Police Service, or even in the other organized forces. And it is intertwined with the fact that some of our organized forces are not properly taken care of, that their salaries are not there. Some of them are really, really suffering. We know that. We know that as a nation we have some challenges related to our finances.
Abram, why is it very difficult to put a padlock and take away key to arsenal's houses where stores where you have these guns so that this proliferations of arms in the hand of civilian does not happen? Why is it not happening?
It's more than just locking the door. Uh-huh. You can well close it, but if you have not closed the heart and the minds of individuals, they can still open that. So it's about if the storekeepers are properly trained, if the storekeepers are properly given the resources that they need so that they can be able to do what we call physical security and stockpile management. Mm. So if the storekeepers are given what they need, there will be no way that they can allow, you know, some of these guns.
Thank you, Coach. We shall come back. We have been joined by Maria Oniwa. She's an integration international expert with DDR Commission. Welcome, madam.
Thank you.
Yeah, we shall come back to you. Dr. Abram, as an independent analyst, security analyst in the country, you have heard from Wilson and Abram Coach putting forward their argument as in line with their institution they come from. What do you have to say with these insecurities as a result of small arms, and especially small arms that bring about a communal conflict in the country?
Yeah, thank you very much, James, for welcoming me to the round table today, and some of the colleagues that had joined me from the Small Arms and the DDR Commission. The topic that we are discussing today is a topic that is a serious nuclear and the core of everything of insecurity in this country. And you could see into it that despite the fact that we had a lot of work that is being done by small arms and the DDR, in my opinion, these institutions, they have not really been empowered to be able to do the nature work that they are supposed to do. And this need a willingness from the government to be able to see into it that these institutions are given the right mandate and independency that they need. Now, coming back to why small arms has become a major problem in promoting intercommunal conflict, you could see into it that the number of factors and motivational factors that are involved. One of them that I would talk is the economic motivation. You could see into it that because of the availability of the small arms, you could see young men mobilizing themselves, going to raid cattle from another community, come and sell those cattle so that they could get extra income, or raid the same cattle at the same time, use the same cattle for settling their communal, maybe their personal interests, like getting married. And also the community, because of its economical value, the community is also trying to promote that by trying to compose songs, for example, and making those people who are trying to raid other people cattle and maybe hijack people along the highway by treating them as heroes. And this thing is really becoming a motivational factor among the young people. Secondly, you could see also there is what we call also political motivation and or incitement as per se, because you have seen into it that in this country it has become a culture that rebellion is always rewarded, and you cannot rebel if you don't have a backup by your communities. So now the presence of small arms among the civilian make them to be the only source that could motivate the leaders to be able to revenge against the system that has been set up by the constitution. And you could see somebody could be able to beat up their chest, especially the politician, by saying, "The president, you have no power to remove me. If you remove me, I can also mobilize my community so that also we remove your government." And this has become also a motivation factor. Now, this person who was, for example, a grade 7 or a grade 5 in the government, going into the bush, coming back, make a minister. Then somebody who was a director general will say, "Oh, I think if this one is the case, then I should go come back a vice president." Okay, because if an inspector can become a minister, what about me DG? What about me undersecretary? What about me the former minister, the former MP? What are we going to do then? So this has become now a culture which has also been enshrined into the life of the people, and people began talking about it very openly. It is not anything Dr. which Abraham, is hidden. Yes.
Dr. Abraham, as an academician and special on security, you have been involved in so many policies, that security policies in the country. What do you advise the government and the civilian on the way out of this situation? Because as you explained, for sure it is grievous. So what do you advise DDR and small arm controls in the house with you to do?
Well, thank you very much. In fact, number one of what need to be done is what most of them have been talking about here, that is putting the law in place. And most of them have tried. We have Small Arms Act. Now there is going to be a DDR Act very soon. Mm. So that is the priority number one.
Yes.
Priority number two is the willingness of the government to be able to implement that law and order in latent spirit, so that now there will be no discriminations against the people who had become the victim of the same law. Now, you see, because of this spirit of rebellion, now the government has become very reserved of taking the lead in making sure that they combat insecurity within the country. Because if the government, for example, if there's disarmament in town, for example, and the government intervened, now some few politicians from the town will say, "You see, this government is against us and they are coming to kill our people."
Okay, so now if the same thing is done in Tony, the same thing is done in Western Barakazal, the same thing is done in Equatoria, the same thing is done in Upper Nile, then all those politicians will gather together and believe that it is the people that are being targeted. And that becomes another agenda of regime change, and that is what the government is fearing.
Okay, we shall come back to you. Maria Honewa, welcome to the studio. I think this is your first time to be in this studio. I understand that you have been in the country for some times,
sure.
and you are an advisor, integration advisor to DDR Commission. What do you see? What is your experience with the DDR and the prevalence of small arms in the hands of civilians in the country?
Thank you very much. First of all, the whole point for the current DDR effort is to prevent the violence, prevent to rearm and re-recruit those youth or those groups who are vulnerable.
Mm.
Having said that, now South Sudan, it is in the context that many people coming back to the community. Those are the one, perhaps maybe those who are displaced by war, returnees, and IDPs.
Yes.
Don't forget that ex-combatants as well, they are the one as part of the returnees coming back to the community. The point for the sustainable peace and development is how to accommodate those returnees who can be part of the civilian agent to contribute to rebuild the community, rebuild the social fabric, social cohesion, and build the peace. Now, there are so much talking about some of them, the youth who are at risk of re-recruitment or to revert to the violence. The whole point for the DDR or the small arm light weapons, etc., is that about the government, whole of government approach,
mm-hmm.
that how to support, how the ministries who are in charge of, for instance, the health or the security, they are themselves to perform their function to provide the protection for those civilians.
I understand that DDR Commission is mainly focusing on ex-combatants. And for sure, if you put a ratio of ex-combatant versus the youth that are armed, civilian that are armed, we'll be told by Small Arm Commission later on, maybe the greater portion of the population is armed. The civilian are more armed than the ex-combatant that you are targeting to reintegrate into the society. Now, what do you do with the ex-combatant that are coming back to a greater population that is already armed and they have not been disarmed? Are you not seeing a risk that this ex-combatant would be rearmed as civilian now? Or as ex-combatant in the society, because they have to defend their property, they have to defend themselves against the revenge. So, what is the security? What is the security of this ex-combatant that you are bringing from the military into the civil life?
Okay, I think let me interject in this question.
Yes,
in the DDR Commission mandate,
yeah,
and the DDR Commission. Term of reference as well, it has been clearly put that the DDR Commission will contribute to the blanket civilian disarmament in South Sudan.
Mm.
The portion of DDR Commission will just be a contribution, and this contribution will be forged by the two institutions sitting together to devise how best they can complement each other. We have initiated this initiative so far. The DDR Commission, together with Small Arms Bureau, have set and they discuss that the technical group will work out how best the two institutions will work to answer the question of us complementing each other. Yeah. So our contribution as DDR Commission to the armed proliferation in the community is just a contribution. And it is a contribution that will be stipulated in the document that will be signed by two institutions.
Lual, and to your colleague in the studio, this is a question any one of you can answer. What benefit, what dividends do you give? Because you have to make being disarmed with no arm more attractive than having a firearm in your hand. So what are you? What benefit are these people getting? The ex-combatant you are targeting to reintegrate into the society.
Yeah, there are a number of benefits that the ex-combatants can get in the DDR program. Most of these are very clear, and we have been making this one very clear in any public rally that we are making to them. You know, we look at our life currently, and we see the life of our soldiers. If you compare with the simple life of our soldier, a private, and with the life of a private businessmen in the market, you can figure out for yourself. So if an ex-combatant is disarmed, demobilized, and reintegrated, the reintegration we mean is by training this person, giving him an alternative skill to be able to live outside the gun life. So if that person is given an alternative skill to live outside the gun life, take for example, just becoming a simple carpenter in the market, there are a lot of benefits that the guy is going to get. Because number one, he's going to live with his family. He's not going to be moving from one point to another. He's going to get his income daily. He's not going to get his income after 6 months or 2 months.
Are you providing capital to them?
We are giving them training. Giving them a startup kit.
All right.
So okay. This is very important.
I understand Maria wants to add something. Maria?
Yeah, thank you. So I was talking about a little bit of different groups coming back to the community. That is a case in South Sudan.
Yeah.
And when I was, for instance, the relevant program in other regions of the world is, for instance, to trying to target those community who have more groups of youth who are at risk or who are maybe revert to violence, where there are not much socioeconomic opportunity. Sometimes we can call like a community violence reduction program. That meant that the DDR reintegration program, and one of the tools is to trying to target those community where there are some problem, to benefit both the ex-combatants as well as the youth at risk for any possible program, for instance, to address the issues of mental health, psychosocial issues, to probably to have some community rebuilding activity, for instance, to, let's say, some underlying root causes of conflict or poverty, for instance, the land issues or the water scarcity, or maybe the frequent disaster that again put the community impoverished for the gains made during the activity of agriculture, for instance, let's say maybe in a jungle flood. So, for instance, proactively, for instance, after the flood, I heard in the Jonglei state, communities are building the dikes. And some of the government, some of the donors who are interested in having some pledge to support building a dike for preventing the disaster.
To recur.
Yeah, to recur. So that could be done with a community and those ex-combatants who express and chose the area or the community of return we could perhaps provide some package, you know, the community rebuilding and a disaster prevention project that benefit the youth at risk and benefit the ex-combatants as well to jointly rebuild the community. But that can be done together with the community leaders and state governors. So you see, it is, should be that it should come along not only the small arm light weapons or the DDR. It should be something, the part of the community rebuilding, the nation building, the peace building.
Okay.
You see, that is a peace agreement implementation. That's kind of the essence. It covers whole aspect of political security to the socio-economic part. I'm mentioning about, therefore, saying about ministry, different ministry who can play the role, and then trying to have the institutional human rights and most NGOs. Important, rule of law.
All right.
And a DDR SSR response to those human rights violations. And said that the violence is about human rights violation.
All right.
And the law prohibits that. But it takes time for each institution to play their roles, including the police and security, who now we are trying to unify. So,
okay,
yeah,
thank you very much, Maria. We shall come back to this point. Very interesting point. Abraham Kuch, we have two Abraham in the studio. Abraham Kuch, does your Bureau of Small Arm Controls and Community, do you have a statistic of small arms that estimatedly that you can estimate to be in the hands of a civilian?
Yes, we do.
Let our listeners know on that. Then also, what are you doing in order to mitigate, together with that question, what are you doing as a bureau to mitigate insecurity across the country? Because you said before that you are planning for the general disarmament, comprehensive disarmament, in your own words. This comprehensive disarmament needs resources, for sure. It needs time to plan. And as I understand, you have been moving from one state to a state. But it's, but issues of life are urgent. Issues of security are neighbor do not really need enough time. So what are you doing in order to intervene and save more life? Because the more time you take, the more time the more lives we lose.
Thank you very much. First of all, can I just try to answered something a little bit to our relation with DDR.
Sure, welcome.
It is in our strategic plan and in our, you know, the strategy of the civilian disarmament, we clearly stipulated that anyone that is not considered as ex-combatant, if you are not an ex-combatant based on the definition of the DDR, and you are holding gun illegally, that means you are a civilian. And so you fall directly under the small arms control. And there is a clear distinction that people need to understand. DDR deals with ex-combatant.
Right.
We deal with civilians that are carrying guns illegally. And it is not our responsibility to disarm civilians. We provide the legal framework. We provide the roadmap for the government, for other government agencies like the National Police Service, the SPDF, the National Security Services. They are the one who are actually involved in the real collections of the guns in the hand of the civil population. What we do is, one, to conduct awareness and sensitization, something that we are doing at the moment. And once we do that, we give these agencies guiding principles on how disarmament can be done. And having said that, in terms of the statistic, there was a survey that we did in 2016. We did that survey with the small arm survey based in Geneva and the UNDP. And we found that the guns that are in the circulation illegally held by the civil populations are between 700,000 between 600,000 to 700,000. And that was only done in the six states. We couldn't do it in Lake State. We couldn't do it in
So in six states, you have 700,000.
Yes. We estimated that the guns are being held by a civil population, that there's 700,000. And Central Equatorial State seem to be the state that with the highest number of guns in the circulation. You will find that a household could at least have two guns. You know, some of the household in Warab, in Northern Barghazal, in Jongle, you can find that a household can at least have one gun or so. or not even at all. So we estimate that there are about 700,000 guns being held illegally by the civil population. What we're doing as the Bureau for the Community Security and Small Arms Control is to provide the government with a legal framework and that we call a national strategy on the removal of the firearms from the hand of the civil population, and this is something that we are doing now. It is the document is already done, and we are making people aware of the document. We are only left now with Eastern Equatoria, Jonglei, and Malakal.
Over 700,000 arms in the hands of civilian. Mm. This is a big number, and for sure it is a serious security threat to the peace that we are implementing, and even to the lives of civilians. So, what resources do you have at the government to disarm? Because 700,000, I do not know the numbers of our men in uniform, but I think it exceed the 700,000. It exceed the number of men in the uniform. So how possible is it? Are you going to disarm 700,000 in only 6 states? We are talking 6 states. If we include the other 4 states, we could be having 1 million and something.
Yes, it could be more. You know what we're saying is, it's a no-brainer now. There is an argument that we are saying civilians are even more armed than our national army, but. If we are going to do the disarmament, that's why we are saying now, we don't have the enough force or the manpower that can do the disarmament in South Sudan all at once, you know? So we'll say that disarmament can be done on paces, or even on corridors. And for us to be able to do that, we have to start with those who are willing to give up their arms freely or bluntly. So as a government, yes, resources may not be available at the moment, and that's why we are in discussion with the Ministry of Finance to increase the budget that we have. The budget that we have does not cover the activities that are available, and other international partners are not actually working us in this area now. They're not supporting the government now because of some economic restrictions on the government. So it is very difficult for us to do this on our own, but we need some support from the international agencies and even our own government. Okay. You can hear what Dr. Abram was saying. It's in place. If we don't have a national consensus, if we don't have the political will of the leadership to support these institutions, we cannot be able to deliver some of the documents that we have.
Thank you. Abram, listening to Kuch, especially with the numbers of small arms that are in the hands of the civilian, it is serious. It is serious, and the lack of resources in order to disarm and bring take these guns from the hands of civilian is a challenge that they are facing. So, as an expert, a security expert, what do you think is the reason why there are communal conflict? There is a rise of a communal conflict in the society. Of course, it could be partly as to what Abram explained and Lual earlier on. What solution do we have to bring in here in order to ease disarmament process and help the process as explained by DDR and small arms control?
Yeah, thank you, James, once more, and I'd like to appreciate my colleague for elaborate explanations of some of the issues that are related to the DDR. And before I come to that point, there's something that I want to reiterate again, first of all, based on what Lwale said before, and this is about mostly what need to be done to these people who are just whom guns had been removed. And in fact, he has explained two documents, the reintegration strategy and reinsertion strategy. And these are some of the things that people really don't understand very well. Because for you to be able to disarm and demobilize the soldiers, ex-combatant in most cases, you have to do it at two phases. That is, the first phase is what is dealing with reinsertion strategy. This is a short term, like you are removing a gun from somebody today. What is that thing that is going to replace gun maybe in the mind and the hand of that person? So that program of 3 to 6 months, that is what we call reinsertion program.
Then now, after 6 months, this is where you go to develop a skill into this person, impact economic skills that will make this person to become independent. And this is where now we are talking about reintegration. And that one now is done in conjunction with the communities that are there, because if you make ex-combatant to benefit more than the people that are, more than the community that they are being integrated in, that thing always create conflict. And you have to be very careful on what to do about that thing. And I think this is where mostly the resources that are very limited, sometimes when they deal with the soldiers and they did nothing with the civil population, the community, in terms of social corporate responsibility, it make it very difficult. Now, coming to why, what should be done to make sure that civilians should be able to bluntly, as Kuja said, give in their weapons. You have seen into it that we have a concept of security dilemma. And this is whereby you are seeing your neighbor as two guns, and you have only one gun. And you know that definitely if there is disarmament, your neighbor is going to give in one and going to be remaining with one. Then you will still feel insecure. You have to make sure that that one of yours, you have to hide it very, 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 very seriously, so that nobody will be able to get it. Now, looking at the number of the overall army in South Sudan, yeah, I think mostly if the number that we have, if it is too big, the whole security force is put together, it will be around 300,000 to 400,000. Okay? All the security forces in across the country.
Yes.
And now looking at that number is just like is a quarter of the civil population that is having small arms. And what need to be done here, it need a lot of work to be done by the government. By the government to be able to create an environment that will make people to believe that they are very safe. And this is where we need to create a lot of awareness among the communities, and so that we tell the people, now, if you have your gun, and you cannot be able to go and raid other people's cattle, because the government will be able to respond. And this way we'll talk about some of the best practices later on within the region about how countries were able to deal with such a thing. So we should see into it that guns has become part and parcel of the people's lives. And because it has become part and parcel of people's life, we need the government to make it a priority in their programming, so that they should be able to give a good budget to the institution concerned, and most of that budget should go to more of changing the mindset that the gun is what is very helpful to you, rather than a physical taking of the people. And that is what could be able to make people change their heart and their mind to be able to bluntly give in their arms.
Dr. Abram, you analyst in social media and in academic institutions, earlier argued that before the formation of the Artiguno, when government was not formed, in the national government was not reconstituted, the argument was that insecurity was as a result of government having not been formed, revitalized government having not been formed. And for sure, when the government was formed at national level, still insecurity persists. Then another argument that was advanced by some analysts also was that, okay, state governments have not been reconstituted, have not been formed, and that is why we still have insecurities at subnational levels. State governments institutions were later formed, but still this still persists. So what is it that is elusive here in between here that is not happening? That's why insecurity still persists in the country.
Yeah, you see into it that there are many factors that are contributing to insecurity in the context of South Sudan. And one of the factors that we could be able to see into it, that some of those people who have said because the government, the revitalized government, national unity is not fully formed, or maybe the state government is not fully formed, might be right to some very small extent, but not to a very large extent. The reason is that you have seen into it that insecurity in South Sudan here is being associated with competition over resources. So that is one. Over resources, in what sense? You see our security forces, they don't have the remuneration that is being given to them is not enough. So you could see most of them might be a very good peaceful person during the day, but at night they might turn into some other agents that will be able to get something to provide for their families.
Sure.
And if that thing is not done, to me, in my opinion, insecurity will not be stopping in this country.
Okay.
That is one. Secondly, you could see it into it that the politicians that are that are carrying the remote, the security remote of this country, once they are not made to be happy and when they don't agree on one factor, then insecurity will not stop. And one of the examples that I can give to you, you could see the recent insecurity along the Yei Highway, along the Nimli Highway. You could be able to ask yourself, where does this insecurity come from?
I sorry for to interrupt you. I think this is a very interesting point, and we are coming to that after.
Okay, thank
let's
you.
Let's go for a break. Mm-hmm. You have been listening to Radio Maria Roundtable with me, Yaj Grang. We are looking at small arms control, communal conflict, and status of DDR commission in South Sudan, DDR program in South Sudan. And you will join us in the second hour. You will call on 0912062950 or 0921902950. Stay tuned to the for the next session.
101 FM Radio Miraya, powered by the people, uniting the nation. Your preferred station, the voice of peace.
Antum tastami'una ila Radio Miraya. You're listening to Radio Miraya.
Welcome back to Roundtable, second session of this program. We are looking at small arm control, communal conflict, and status of DDR in program in South Sudan. And in the studio, we are joined by Wilson Lual. He's a national expert on DDR Commission and acting executive secretary of DDR Commission. We have Abram Kush, director of small arms control in the Bureau of Community Security and Small Arm Control in the Ministry of Interior. Then we, in the studio too, we are joined by Dr. Abram Kwalnyuan, is the Dean of College of Economic and Social Studies, University of Juba, and national security expert too. Then we have Maria Onhewa, Reintegration International Expert with DDR Commission. Welcome to the studio, and in the second session, you will also join us. You will be calling us on the line 0912062950 or 0921902950. Dr. Abram, you were explaining something that is in the interest of our listeners, and this is what recently happened on the Nimli-Juba Highway, the issue of insecurity. Can you proceed from there?
Yeah, thank you once more, James. And I was saying that there are a number of factors that are contributing to issues of insecurity in South Sudan. And I had already highlighted one, that the issue of remunerations of the security agents, that they are not well remunerated. And as a result of that, they resort of using whatever the means that they have, the small arms, whether by using them to get some income for their own families. That is one. Secondly is what I may call the issue of political incitement, and this one mostly come from the politician themselves. And I was trying to cite one of the example of the Nimli Highway and the Yei Juba Road, in the sense that you are currently seeing that the Artigonu is in negotiation with the Soma, okay.
and you could see into it that for Soma to be able to stress their point very well on the negotiation table, they have to cause one instability here and there. And in my opinion, this rise of insecurity along the highway is being instigated by the rebels that are outside, so that they have strength of negotiating and the demand to be fulfilled by the government. By the revitalized government of the national unity. And this is not the first time. This is how it has been in South Sudan, always. And that is what the IOs were doing. That is what others feel they saw were doing. And this has become a culture. And now you could see into it that mostly they will cause insecurity and deny and say that we have not caused insecurity.
So but in a nutshell, Dr. Abraham, you are saying that this recent insecurity between Juba and Nimili is an act of SOA members. The parties that are not part of revitalized agreement. And if that is, and if it is so, then what would be their interest? Because they have signed a cessation of hostility. They signed it recently, and a cessation of hostility means ceasing fire for some time until one comprehensive permanent ceasefire is signed. So what would be the interest?
Thank you very much. You have seen into it that we had been having stability now, I could say, it for almost 2 years. There had been no issues along the highway.
Sure.
There had been no issues along the places that are controlled by SOMA.
Mm.
But you could see into it that there are signs that SOMA's interest and their request are not being accepted by the delegation at the peace talk.
Mm.
So the only thing to do politically and security-wise is to create an environment that will instill fear on the other side of the table, so that they could see into it that, because you have seen now, if this situation continue, for example, for the next 6 months, don't you see that thing is going to cause problem? Because there will be hoarding of few goods that are there, prices will be high, and this could be another way of that could bring problems to the government. And government will immediately accept their demand. When they said we need two vice presidents, they will even accept. Just watch at the space, and that is what is going to happen.
Okay, the DDRA national expert in the program. Can you tell us and our listeners for sure whether DDR, you explained earlier before that all the documents are prepared, they are ready, some are ready to be signed, some are already are in operations. Have the process of DDR, actual process, practical process in the containment sites, in the training centers, have this happened?
Thank you very much for welcoming me again. I was enumerating a number of activities that have been carried out by DDR Commission before, and I think I have to continue from there.
Mm.
As all of you are aware, that the number of documents have been drafted by DDR Commission and are passed by NTC, there have also been a number of activities that DDR Commission have conducted. One of them is the operationalization of DDR institution. All of you are aware that DDR Commission is not a new institution. It has been existing, but it is only reconstituted at the national level. So the number one thing is to operationalize all the 10 state DDR Commission offices, which has been done already.
All right.
And that was followed by a sensitization of all the cantonments and the barracks, plus the training centers. You know, the clients or the DDR ex-combatants are spread in all the areas that we have mentioned. If I can take you back to the agreement, it is stipulated that the DDR ex-combatants will be those that will not qualify for the unified forces. So all those that will not qualify comes from all institutions that are existing, security institutions that are existing in South Sudan, plus the opposition institutions. Among them is the barracks of the SSPDF, the headquarters of national security, the headquarters of national police, the headquarters of wildlife, many other things. These are the people that will go through a very thorough screening, and the ex-combatants will come out from there. So we have gone through some areas, especially the barracks in the states. We have done very good sensitization there. We have also gone to cantonments, we sensitized them, and we went to training centers and sensitized them about the forthcoming DDR.
So, go ahead.
The other activity that we have conducted is the selection of transitional facility sites in all the 10 states of South Sudan. By what I mean by a transitional facility site is a training site that DDR will be conducting the preparatory trainings for the ex-combatants to transition them to the reintegration of the DDR program. So in all parts of South Sudan, we are supposed to have in each state one transitional facility. But so far, we try to attach the transitional facility with a state that has the cantonment. So Lake State and Warap do not have the cantonment site, so we do not have the transitional facility there. We have selected the sites for the transitional facility in the other 8 states that have the cantonment sites. And then we have to wait until when these things are operational, we will see if there is need for the states that do not have the cantonments. The other activity is the conduct of the baseline survey. You know, when DDR is preparing for the ex-combatants to go through the reinsertion and reintegration, there has to be a baseline information that is available in the DDR database. So we have already a database system that we call the ICRS system. This is the system that we call the Information Counseling and Referral System that we can use to refer and reintegrate all the ex-combatants into the communities. So for us to be able to have the information in the ICRS system, we have to conduct the baseline survey in all the communities that the ex-combatants will be returning to map out the opportunities that are available there. We fit all these opportunities into our database so that once we are demobilizing an ex-combatant, we will be able to guide that ex-combatant based on the activities that are available in his communities of return. So we have conducted that survey. We have collected the data. We are currently analyzing the data. We have already 4 analysts in place. Probably in 1 month to come, we'll be able to complete that survey. Once that survey is ready, then now the DDR Commission now will be ready to receive the ex-combatants. But already, as all of you are aware, the DDR Commission is ready to now receive the ex-combatants once the funds are available to the DDR Commission. But as we speak, the DDR Commission has not yet, unfortunately, received the funds for receiving and servicing the ex-combatants that will come out from the screening. And also, unfortunately, the screening has not been done. The
screening has not been
by
done.
By the MCC.
What happened to Unified Forces when they went for trainings? Were you involved? Did you do some screening? And if you did some screening, what happened to the people you might have screened out?
You are aware that DDR Commission was formed late. There were some other mechanisms that were formed before DDR. Most of them are known to you. The JDB, that is the Joint Defense Board. The JMCC, the Joint Military Commission, and then the JTSC, that is dealing with the training and screening of ex-combatants. DDR was to be part of the screening, but because it was formed late, the screening was supposed to be done by JMCC together with JTSC. But it did not go as planned because of some obstacles and all of that. People have to move from cantonment sites to training centers without screening. So DDR Commission have been waiting to have that screening conducted and get the results of the screening that will help us now to receive the ex-combatants and be able to service those ex-combatants that are screened based on the agreement criteria. But the screening has not been done.
Thank you. We have a question here from John Mayangong from Torit. He said, this country needs to be free from firearms in the hands of civilians, and in my opinion, the following need to be done. One, peaceful disarmament through ships and reassurance that their property and cattle are protected. One. Two, introduction of taxes. This, and we have to underline this thing. We are coming, taking this question to Coach. Introduction of taxes to be levied on guns owners. Three, forceful disarmament. Then his question is, my question is, the disarmament has been done before. Do you think it would be possible this time around, Coach?
Well, I think that, as I said before, that we have lessons learned from previous disarmament. Mm-hmm. What we're saying right now, as I said before, the disarmament that's supposed to be done now should be peaceful. And once it's peaceful, it involves all the other stakeholders that what was the name Mayen was talking about.
Mayen, yeah.
If you are to do the disarmament, chiefs and other traditional leaders are very much key stakeholders in this. So, like, for instance, it's a chief that knows how many people in the locality have the weapons. And that's how we did the survey. We did not do the survey without the involvement of chiefs and other traditional leaders. Mm. And so, and let us make this thing very clear. Firearms are not the problem. It is their use, you know. Mm. So we could even have how many firearms, but when the people who are using the firearm are more sensible enough to be able to use them responsibly, we could not be able to have this sort of insecurity that we are seeing right now. It is the misuse of the firearm that is the big problem. So if we are saying that disarmament is going to be done, it should start bluntly. You know, why we are saying bluntly, there is a reason for that. Because once we start off with the postful disarmament, this is where sometimes you have not answered some of the concerns, like the protections. Some people are saying they are having guns because they want to protect their properties, they want to protect themselves, or they are using that gun as a source of livelihood. So there are preconditions for you to do so that you arrive at the actually collection stage. Like, for example, for those who are saying it is source of their livelihood, what kind of alternative are we going to provide for those people? You know, you have to provide an alternative source of livelihood for communities or individuals that use guns as source of their livelihood. So it is true, disarmament has been done in the past, but the disarmament that has been done in the past was occasioned by the fact that, you know, there was insecurity or there was violence in the communities where disarmament was done. Yeah, there was never be a national disarmament that was done nationwide collectively, but there were disarmament that's always done at the pockets of places.
And you can use this question and use this platform as a way of dissemination your information that you have been going around with in the state.
Yeah.
And what you said earlier is speaking to what you could be doing in your sensitization program.
Mm.
What do you tell citizens, what do you tell civilians that are armed in the state, you have just come from Lagos State, what do you tell them the alternative way of having arms? You said for sure that arms are not the problem. The problem are people. So what message are you giving them to believe you that arms are not the problem? You can even stay with 10 firearms in your house, but still they can be less harmful. You can use them maybe to defend yourself from an animal that attacks you at night. That is one. Another one is the question of alternative resource, especially with resource. So, are you promising? Are you in collaboration with DDR Commission? And probably give them an alternative that would come later on during peaceful disarmament, because somebody would want to give up something when there is something for it.
Well, as I said before, I have told you about the statistic of the gun in the hand of our civil population. I said there are about 700,000. That's a high number of people for you to be able to pay individuals. So what we say as a country, there's something called collective incentive, whereby if a community, say for instance, and by the way, Lake State is one of the states now that is actually embarked on the voluntary civilian. I think you have been seeing on the national TV.
Right.
And thanks to the governor, Gerald Makurkulang, for the way he's actually engaging these communities. You can see that they are willingly giving out their guns. So what the government will come up with, if the government cannot provide individual incentives so that individuals are given a payback sort of appreciation, the government can come up with the roadmap, something called collective incentive. Say, for instance, in Lake State, you can go with the schools, you can go with roads, you can go with hospitals for the communities that accept to be disarmed voluntarily. And that's the reason we are saying this is once you say you will be giving people money, you will actually be encouraging an illicit market. it means that somebody might actually have five guns. What are you going to do? Are you going to pay that somebody with five guns with some money? Or somebody can run from Rumbek to go to Jonglé, for instance, go and get a gun from Jonglé once he has actually been paid already, and come with another gun saying that this is my gun again. Are you going to pay that same sort of person? We said no. But we are not completely ruling these things out. We are saying that this thing has to be have some academic research on this,
all right,
so that we come up with the proper modalities on how to answer.
Okay, let us see if we call here, and we shall come back to that. Hello, Radio Maria.
Hello.
Yes, your name and your question briefly, please. Hello.
Hi, Nabil.
Yeah, your question. So, what be talk? Hello? Okay, Kuch, I think we have network problem with that line.
Yes.
Yeah, you can come back to the question.
So as I said, the idea of maybe giving individuals some sort of livelihood or maybe some sort of incentive is not something that we encourage very much. In a way, maybe we can provide someone with, if you are an agriculturalist, we can provide you with tractors or maybe ox plow, something that you can use.
Collectively to that community.
To the community, something that you can use.
Instead of individual.
On individual, something that you can use.
Maria, as an international expert to DDR Commission in South Sudan, what lessons have you learned from South Sudan that makes your previous experience different from this one? And if anything can be learned from your previous experience, especially with regard to DDR program? Welcome. Okay, my question is this. I'm saying, as an international expert to DDR Commission in South Sudan, where you have worked previously, you came with some experience. And experience are not the same. Experience from one country to country one to and country B could be different. And so my question is, your experience that you have gotten here in South Sudan for a few months that you have stayed here in South Sudan, what lessons have you learned in South Sudan that make previous experience different? And if previous experience different, your previous experience might be having some lessons that could be applied here in South Sudan, and there could be success stories in South Sudan. So different lessons have you learned in South Sudan that makes it different, and what can we learn from your previous experiences?
Thank you very much. You see, DDR is very much linked to the SSR, and usually it is a part of the peace agreement implementation. And in many countries, like for instance, I was in DRC or maybe in Abyei, Sudan, and maybe any other country colleague worked, Central African Republic, Haiti, etc. There are so much needs faced by the country, not only for the government itself, but also to those civilians, you see, who are recovering from the war, and as I mentioned about massive return and of the refugees and IDPs from the protection site to etc. Now, there are so much needs and so much problems. However, we are facing the fact that there are some limited resources
here in the country.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, as DDR, SSR are part of the peace agreement implementation, the importance is to how to sustain the peace. You see? And with limited resources, and things still, there's still the absence of state authority, the state institutions, for instance, the police, right? Or the unified forces to provide the protection, that is, we are still trying to work out. In such context, the lessons learned, or something that we want to call for all the government, as well as all the Sudanese civilian population or the international community, is that how to, how to have the ownership for each citizens and each government to play the role. Oh. And if possible, you see, we have to see that we have to prevent the violence, and we have to prevent the reverse of the peace agreement, the game made. So in such context, what are the importance, you know? We have to really target and consolidate some support to prevent, you see? So that means some targeted area-based programming, which highlighted some of the success for DRC, for instance, where still there is no state authority. Some armed groups trying to control the area, rich in the mineral, you see, because there is no police state institution. So they are the one trying to recruit the youth at risk. Yeah.
Okay.
And there is still, in the meantime, that there are much needs for those, the children associated with armed forces and groups. They need to be reunited with the family.
Their families.
Address the issue of returning to the community where they may have committed the crimes.
Okay.
So that means, I guess that one of the things successful one in DRC is about the targeted community, area-based programming. Mm. That actually benefited not only the child soldiers,
but for the community.
But the whole community and the youth at risk, as well as including those victims of sexual violence, for instance. So all together, but the necessity is that since the institution is still weak, still rebuilding, so how to go about it? You see, that means to address the immediate need of the community.
The community. Okay.
The food, the education, the health services. So WFP, for instance, UNICEF, school feeding program, WFP provided something, food for work, to create an alternative for the youth at risk rebuild the irrigation, etc. So what I would like to highlight is a targeted approach would be good, and trying to consolidate all the governmental effort. For instance, the Minister of Agriculture can play an important role
in this year.
To have some agricultural activity, agricultural development. Ministry of Education can have some vocational training and the livelihood training, and for those, you know, who are necessary to be equipped. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Let's receive some more calls. Hello, Radio Mirai? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, your name and your question briefly, please.
My name is Franco Sebit. I'm calling from Jebel.
Franco, yes, go ahead. Your question?
So I'll be taking a lot of time. I'm going to do more of it. I'm going to do special for you, Sudan. And لأن سلاح بجمعه ما بيحرقه وسلاح السلاح الموجود في جنوب السودان ده سلاح ما عنده نمرة ما عنده النمرة سيستم يعني مثلا سلاح رجب أو واسط الشعار وده موجود في كثير من الشعب عشان كده أنا بقول دي دي آر المفروض هو مع يعمل كونفرشن مع الحكومة عشان إنه يجمع سلاح من المواطنين سواء كان إنه يعني يجمع سلاح ده يحرقه بدل ما هو يخطب لا ما يخطب وين في المخزن بيشيله تاني بقى جوال المواطن الحال شنو في زي حتى سلاح بقى مشكلة بالنسبة للمواطن ذاته بقى في تحديات كبيرة يا هو ناس بقتلوا حتى أطفال صغار لا أدري نسوا بقتلوا بس هو بسوا في السلاح الموجود موجود إلى المواطن يا هو حصل قبل يومين في ما يوم فأنا حال بقول بس على الزي دي ار أو الناس المرضى الحال شنو بالنسبة للي يجمعوا سلاح ده بعدين بعدين تخرج القوات ده ما ممكن سلاح يجمعوا في رومبيك ولا في وارب في قبيلة واحد ورد يكون مجموعة من القبائل بتاع جنوب السودان أو جيش واحد عشان يجمع سلاح ما يجمع ناس معين كان ناس معين بيحصل مشاكل زي ما حصل في وارب ناس ما تفوقوا فده مفروض يخرجوا الجيش ده عشان يكون في حل.
Thank you. Hello Yes, your name and your question briefly, please.
Thank you, please. You are speaking to Mabora from Rumbek.
Mabora, yes, from Rumbek, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I welcome the guest to the studio and I appreciate their presence. You know, my question will go direct to the one in the Ministry of Interior.
Yes, that is Abraham.
You know, there are several developments that have been taking place, especially here in Rumbek. The disarmament is completed. the guns are taken to Cuba. After 3 to 2 months, the guns came back to the
state.
To the civilian, yeah.
Mm.
So what is my question is like this. To whom should be blamed for this return of the guns? Are we blaming the civilian or the you people in the exterior, in the government?
Or in the government?
In the government, because you know, from the introduction before, you said that this guy is the one responsible for the control of
Somalia. Okay,
yeah,
exactly. Thank you, Mobir. Hello, Radio Maria.
Hello, good morning.
Morning, your question briefly, please. Your name and your question.
This is John from Brombeck.
John from Brombeck, yes, John?
Yeah, I have two comments. I don't have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, this belief of saying that has been disarmed several times and they don't work. In the first place, there has never been a proper organization of how these communities can be disarmed. Their failure cannot be blamed on...
Sorry, we lost him. Hello? Hello? Okay. Kuch, you can begin. We can begin with the question from Mobor in Rumbek.
Yes,
who should be blamed?
Yes, yes.
Should you not in the studio, but in the government?
The
next one will go to Abram. I mean to Lual. Is directed to Lual. Then the question from Abram will come from social media. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you. To first of all, I will start with Franco. Franco was actually talking about what are we going to do with once the guns are collected. You know, it's a question that we have been talking about for a very long time, and as a government, we are saying once the collection has been done, there are options that are available. One, if the guns are collected, it is going to be the decision of the government whether these guns are going to be disposed or they are going to be reused or redistributed to the armed forces. If they are to be redistributed to the armed forces, what are we going to do? They can be marked, properly recorded, and then you know that which organization is going to have this sort of weapon. But as he says, we are actually advocating for a complete decompositions of the weapons that are going to be collected from the civilian to avoid the fact that guns are still going into the hand of the continuous proliferation of small arms. And having said that, Mabur is also saying the same kind of thing on who is responsible. Obviously, some of the reason why I have not actually enumerated the reason why there are continuous proliferation of small arms.
Yes.
We say that one reason is there's something called diversion from the legitimate source. What it means is that you could find that the legitimate stores are not properly manned. And that's why these guns are getting out from them to the hand of the civil population. What you need to do is to build a proper storage and then train the people who are manning these stores so that you can be able to manage and control the influx or the outflux of the guns in their stores.
Yeah.
So having said that, obviously the blame goes to the government. It's not individuals that's supposed to be blamed. It is us collectively as a government and as the people of South Sudan. We need also to reduce the culture of demand for guns. Gun, as I said before, is not the problem, but the usage of the gun. If people are not having higher demand for gun, the gun will not be a problem. So we need to talk to ourselves. We need also to blame ourselves as individuals.
Yes. Coach, recently when there was this clash between the neighbors in Unity and in Warabi State, some guns were circulating. I mean, pictures of some very new, brand new guns were circulating on social media. Where do these civilians get new guns?
Well, you cannot possibly ping a phone on one particular source. There are so many other sources where guns can get into the hand. You can say distribution from armed forces or even from armed groups, you know, who are actually in the bush. These civilians can buy them easily from the militias or even rebels or even individual soldiers who have nothing to eat. They can sell that particular gun. So apart from that, there are other, you can see from Bintu, our borders are very open, especially borders between Sudan and South Sudan, and there are some rebel groups that are operating in that corridor. So there is no reason why they cannot give these communities their guns. Look at the corridor with Western Barakazal and Northern Barakazal, the corridor of Central Africa. You have Seleka there, who is very active in that corridor. Easily the guns can filter into South Sudan. So one of the factors that guns are in our countries because our borders are not properly manned.
What happens? We have national army. We have our men in uniform at the borders. What happened?
Well, I think that obviously the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Interior are the one responsible to controlling the borders, and they are actually working on this. But you know, the country is, South Sudan is really a very large country. You cannot really put individuals at all the pockets of the country. You can find that there are still Fanya Road that people can use to come, yes.
Okay, question to DDR, Lual.
Yeah, I think the question that can come to me should be from Franco Sibit.
Yeah, Franco Sibit,
From Jebel.
Yes.
And his question was, I think, divided into two. One question is, why don't we ban the guns instead of having the return of guns for now and then? And then the other question is, why do you disarm the communities one-sided? Why do you disarm one community while the other community is not disarmed? I think that question was properly tackled by Abram Kuch before, and I think I have to also make some comments. Generally, internationally, there is a way in which the arms are managed. One step is what we call WAM, Weapon and Ammunition Management. This is a new system that has just come up now in the UN, and some of us have been trained. I happen to be one that have attended that training from South Sudan with the other colleagues who are international, somebody called Mamedou and the other lady. We have attended that training, and that training is very important. I think if we get an opportunity, we'll touch base, or we'll get in touch with some of our colleagues in community security and small arms control.
Okay.
The best practice that people are using in the world nowadays is to discard the arms that have been collected. And discarding them
means banning them?
Yes.
Destroying them completely?
Yes.
Okay.
That is what is practiced internationally. Because once you collected an illegal weapon, you have to destroy it. But another way of reserving, because these things are resources, if the government is having other means or other use of these arms, the government will have to reclaim them. By what Abram has said clearly before, by marking them and giving them numbers and give them to institutions that will be responsible to the use of these arms. This is what is being used internationally.
Okay.
Yeah. But then the other question is, why do we disarm one side? I think this question goes to community security and small arms control. We have been repeating this one several times in any interview that we do, that the institutions are separate. The community security deals with civilian disarmament, while the DDR Commission deals with military disarmament.
Yeah. Could you answer this question earlier on in his introduction?
And it was answered, this question.
Yeah.
For me, as an individual, I think the disarmament nowadays, the civilian disarmament currently, will not be possible. It needs the blanket approach later on. But that blanket approach will have to be done when the security situation is stable in South Sudan, when the government is in control of the rule of law.
How can government be in control of rule of law when over 700 guns are in the hand of civilians? So, and if we have to wait for that time, when is that time?
You know, these 700 are not organized. They are individuals.
Yeah. But
and the government is organized. So when the government security is in place later on, when the police will be in control, they will be unified, and they will be in control of everything, dealing with this disarmament will be a very simple thing. Let us not be scared with this situation. It can either be done incrementally, like Abram was saying, or can be done blanket-wise.
Okay.
Yes, by just approaching them by using this voluntary disarmament. And then when you know that you have taken, like for example, 500,000 arms voluntarily, you will be left with only 200,000 arms. And you can use force if they don't. Okay. And they become less than their armed force.
Okay, we shall come back to that. Dr. Abram, from your research as academician and security expert, what successful cases of small arms control, DDR program, and communal conflict resolutions in the region or beyond that South Sudan can learn from?
Well, we had several examples that could be cited that had been very successful. And mostly I will not talk of something that is a little bit very far, but I'll just give an example from our neighbors here. And in 90s, Uganda was experiencing the same problems that we are going through.
Right.
And this was a result of LRA. Mostly presence at the border of South Sudan. Mm. And you could see mostly the communities of Pacholi, the Mahdi, the Langos, the Kormajong, they become mostly, they were exactly armed a lot. Mm. And during that time when the South Sudan got peace, it gave them a chance of trying to contribute to the security of Uganda by controlling the border, and some communities who did not see the value of carrying the guns were able to give up bluntly some of their arms, especially along Mahdi Sholi corridors and Langi corridor. But now the Kormajong community was one of the community that is exactly practicing like what South Sudanese are doing. Now they began using some of their guns to create instability within the country and also across the region, which is South Sudan and also Kenya.
Kenya, yeah.
So they were able to go and raid kettles and bring here. Now the government of Uganda came up with a roadmap. It is a forceful disarmament roadmap that most people that were having guns were disarmed by force. It was not a bluntry, because the government has tried for it to be bluntry, but it could not be able to work. And now what was happening, first of all, the government has to sensitize the community that this is the program of the government, and now the government is coming, take up the arms, and anybody that is found with illegal arm that is not supposed to bluntry bring their gun should be held accountable by the government. And when the government of Uganda was able to use not only the ground disarmament, but even the head disarmament, whereby some of the gunship and helicopter they were used to disarm people who are running very fast with some of the gunship that had got the magnet that was able to attract guns from the civil population. And you could see into it that Kormajong community had become part of and parcel of the community that is now trying to reintegrate into their civilian life, and they are able to take over from the things like agriculture that Maria said, and apart from the livestock, and they are not able to disturb their neighbors like Eastern Equatoria and at the same time the Turkana region. And this one could be something that we could be able to learn out of that. And this need our government to be able to take the responsibility and prepare for that. First of all, the first phase that we need to use is to make sure that we sensitize the communities. Civic education is number one. Secondly is trying to ask the people our civic education to know the benefit of not having the guns. And out of that, now the government should be able, as Wilson said, to use force for the few ones that are left. And that could be the best practice that we could be able to learn out.
Thank you, Dr. Abram. We understand that you are going for a next meeting. And can you say your last word before we release you for the next program?
Yeah, thank you very much. I think what I need to say is that for the issue of small arms to become to be solved in this country, first of all, we need to put our house in order. And what do I mean by that? The government need to plan to make sure that the army are well remunerated. That could be the first strategy before when we began thinking about the civil population. So if the police, if the army, the national security, the SSPDF, if they are given good salaries, if they are built barracks, if they are given good accommodations, then that point now we could be able to see into it that we had army that pay allegiance to the government and to the constitution of people of South Sudan. Then number two is to make sure that we use the law that is within the security sector to create accountability. And this is where I was able to appreciate the point that Kuchu was saying, that, you know,
the warehouse for stockpiling of these guns is not a matter of putting a padlock. It's a matter of dealing with the heart and the spirit and the profession of somebody. And this one now, those people, when they the guns are collected, when the guns goes out, some people have to be kept accountable for that thing. And how did this gun disappear again? Because if they are enumerated. And lastly, we should be able to come into it that to avoid the issue of disarming some communities, and some communities will be left with their gun, the government, through either a small arm bureau of small arms, or through DDR, and they should come up with the national roadmap on how the disarmament should be approached. And this one should become another document that should be a national strategy on how small arms should be able to be removed from the people. And that is what I can say. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Abraham. Let us see if we can release you now to go. Let us see if one question before we come back to us. Hello? Yes, your question and...
You are speaking to Simon Dio from Chimel.
Yeah, Simon Dio from Chimel. Yes, go ahead.
Let me slightly comment on the point because of time factor.
Yes.
James, this issue is very, very painful to South Sudan. It has a country. It needs some management. First management... It needs a peace to be circulated among the conflicting communities in order to live in peace. So that when some for disarmament, they will accept, because they know that there is peace. That is the first one.
Yeah.
Second to it, we need to control our borders.
Yeah.
Borders of entry, we need to control them by decreeing the army, the proper army, in order to make the proper management on the border of entry. Because I have seen most of the people that are smuggling the gun to the civilian, and that one create more gun to enter. Apart from that one, we collect it and we take them to the city, and then again they get the gun through smuggling of those people who are involved in smuggling.
Yeah.
So we need to control our borders. Yeah. That one is the second to it. The third to it,
and the last,
we have the government to set the system that can monitor each and any individual who is holding a gun in order to be identified as organized personnel. Because we don't know right now, you can find someone is holding a gun in the bush and we don't know is he organized personnel or not.
Thank you.
When you try to collect back the gun, he will not accept, because you are not sure that he is organized personnel or not. So these are the things that I would like to ask from the...
Thank you for your input, Dio. We begin, because of in the interest of time, let wind up. We begin with Lual. Lual, what is your last word to this talk?
Okay, thank you very much, James. I want to reiterate that the topic that we are discussing today is a very important topic. When we talk about DDR and small arms control, we are talking about security. We are talking about political stabilization. And we are talking about economic stabilization. If we South Sudanese don't own this process and make it our own, we are not going to have political stability. We are not going to have economic stability. We are not going to have security stability. This is the fact. Whether we like it or not, this is the fact that all of us must own, and we must contribute to this to make sure our South Sudan is a secure and a stable South Sudan. So I want to tell our South Sudanese as individuals and the government alike that we must own the DDR process. We must own by paying the price, because nothing can come voluntarily. We must pay the price of what we have done, because this gun that is in the hands of our people is our own making. And we must pay for the price to make sure our South Sudan is free of all these guns and our South Sudan is stable by all means. Because now, if you have a volatile or vulnerable youth that are vulnerable in terms of recruitment, in terms of rebellion, and in terms of insecurity, we are not going to realize what I have said before. But if all South Sudanese are economically stable, economically busy,
Nobody will think about rebellion. Nobody will think about causing insecurity and all of this. So let us pay the price of making our home a secure place.
Thank you, Lual. Coach.
Thank you very much, Yaj Karang, and thank you to all those who are listening to Radio Miraya. And it's been a pleasure to be here. And just to answer what was Dio has said, Dio has actually said a very correct step for us to be able to answer the questions of external source of the firearms entering to South Sudan. And I think one of those is how we can really manage our borders. The other thing Dio has correctly said is the fact that all other organized forces, their guns are not properly recorded. And we need to do that. We need to make sure that their guns are marked, they are properly recorded. And we have done that with the police already. The national security are also doing that. And we are going to do this with the national army. And having said that, I want to say as my last word that voluntary civilian disarmament is something that we are advocating, and it must be supported by a robust legal framework that is understood by the civilian themselves. And that's why we are doing the awareness and sensitization campaign in all the state. So we need to make sure that civilians must be aware of the rationale for us to conduct a disarmament program. And so all the institutions of this country need to support that. We need to have an interactive sessions with all the state's authorities, and it should not end at the state. Awareness should go even to the counties and to the PAYAMS level. And so as an institution, we will require necessary technical support from institutions who are responsible to help us, such as the National Police Service, the SPDF, the National Security. We also need to cooperate with some of our strategic partners like the DDR, the Peace and Reconciliation Commission, for us to be able to successfully achieve our objective. And so, as a last word for me, all of us as South Sudanese need to engage our communities, need to talk to our communities to understand that gun is not the best alternative for us to protect ourselves. Our government is there to protect ourselves. Our government is there to provide the security situation that you need to see in our country. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much all to you, all my guests in the studio. You have been listening to Radio Maraya Roundtable with me, Yaj Gram. We are looking at small arms control, communal conflict, and the status of demobilization and reintegration in South Sudan. In the studio, we are joined by Wilson Lual, National Expert of DDR Commission and Acting Executive Director for DDR. And then we have Abram Kuch, Director of Small Arms Control in the Bureau of Community Security and Small Arms Control in the Ministry of Interior. We had Abram Kuch, who has just left with the studio, is Dean of the College of Economic and Social Studies, University of Juba, and Security Expert. And we have Maria Onewa, Integration International Expert. Thank you very much. Stay tuned for the next program.
101 FM Radio Miraya, powered by the people, uniting the nation, your preferred station, the voice of peace.
أنتم تستمعون إلى راديو ميرايا.
Dear Teacher Ferguson, it has been so long since I attended your lessons. I love and miss your science class. You always make a complicated subject easy for me, especially physics. Now I understand the world a little better. Looking forward to seeing you soon, dear teacher, by your pupil, Miracle Joseph.
The longer children are out of school, the more difficult it is to get them back. Therefore, it is urgent that schools in South Sudan open as soon as possible. UNICEF is supporting the government of South Sudan to reopen schools as soon as possible.
Bad. Clan best music.
Oh, no. South Sudan is one in five. booty booty bum for me. Say my girl, she a got a booty bum for me.
She got a booty 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 bum for me. Say my girl, come here and me.
Telephone, you're dancing for me, girl, your body like a sponge.
Hey, she vibrates like a generator. She got me on her back like a accelerator. Hey,
I let me and you to the sugar. Girl, I love the way you move your body in a corner. Hey,
I let me and you to the sugar.
Girl, I love the way I love the way.